coming to you from one of the great public spaces of the world, Ferry Plaza, along the San Francisco Bay. This is Bikescape. Hey, welcome everybody to Bikescape. I'm sitting here, as I said, by the ferry, watching the ferries come and go. Treasure Island is rising up out of the bay ahead of me. Having a nice cup of Pete's coffee, getting wired here in San Francisco. But this is a show that was recorded in Portland, Oregon during the, it's another in the series of shows from the Towards Car-Free Cities Conference in Portland, Oregon that I got back to from last week. However, the workshop that I recorded, this presentation, was about San Francisco. It was entitled The Battle for San Francisco, kind of an overview of the politics of mobility in a large city like San Francisco, where conflict is a way of life. Politics are tough and mean sometimes, and mobility and transportation is at the center of everything. At the conference, we had Steve Jones, the city desk editor for the San Francisco Bay Guardian, moderated a discussion between Chris Carlson, Dave Snyder, Jason Henderson, and Leah Shaham. I'll let him do the introductions. Came in a couple of minutes late to this one, and so we'll come in just during the middle of Steve's introduction.
Covering the battle for San Francisco, which is a battle for space in the city, I've gotten to know a lot of the fascinating, very effective players involved who we have assembled here at this table. Chris Carlson has been writing about these issues, talking about them as an author and advocate for many, many years. Leah Shaham is the current director of the San Francisco Bike Coalition. Jason Henderson is a geography professor at San Francisco State, who's also very active in citizens councils and advisory groups around town. Dave Henderson was Leah's predecessor.
Dave Snyder.
Dave Snyder, what do we call?
Hey, brother.
Dave Snyder was Leah's predecessor at the Bike Coalition, went on to form a group called Transportation for a Livable City, and is the current Transportation Policy Director at the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association. So what we're going to do is, for the first half of the session, about 45 minutes, I'm going to kind of moderate a discussion among all of them, and we're going to kind of move through some material. We're going to have plenty of time at the end. We're going to save about the last half for questions for all you guys. So, and we hope to kind of turn the second half into a larger discussion that involves all of us. So, we're going to start off with Chris Carlson, talking a little bit about the days before the bicycle movement in San Francisco and kind of how it evolved.
Hi, everybody. Glad to be here. It's great to be in Portland. Nice to be at the Car-Free Cities Conference. Been a very interesting time for all of us, I'm sure. There's a long history, and I'm supposed to do this in 5 to 7 minutes, and it's a little bit tricky to do, but I'm going to try to talk super fast, which if any of you have ever heard me speak before, you know I can do that. First of all, I want to say a couple of things really fast about critical mass. It starts officially at the beginning in September of 1992 in San Francisco, but it wasn't named critical mass at first. It got that name about 2 or 3 months later. It started off being named the Commute Quad. And you're going to see various things going by there, which are graphics from the early rides, and then it turns into pictures of more recent rides, as well as rides in other parts of the world, and some of the flyers and propaganda from other parts of the world. Because obviously it spread like mad after starting in San Francisco in September of 92. It started to crop up in other places really quickly. One of the things that happened after it started was that certain myths became common. One is that I started it, and that's not a really proper understanding of history. I was definitely part of the group that started it, but there was lots of people who were there. There was about 30 or 40, it was about 50 people on the first ride. And there had been a conversation going on amongst several dozen people for a very long time, 6 months to a year at least, prior to the eruption of the first one. And I did go to a meeting of the Bicycle Coalition at that time, back in August, I think it was, of 1992. And at that point, San Francisco Bicycle Coalition, you'll hear about what a giant and powerful organization it is from some of the later speakers, but at that point, it was an organization that had probably under 20 official members and was meeting in the back of a Chinese restaurant once a month and didn't have an office and didn't have any paid staff. And I strolled into it on the driving home from my daughter's, five-year-old daughter's piano lesson with her. I went to the meeting out on the west side of San Francisco and suggested that we should all just get together once a month and ride home. And yeah, everybody thought it was a great idea, and then called me back 2 days later and said, "Don't use our phone number, don't put our name on it." I was like, "Fine, that's fine." We didn't really want to anyway. So as it turns out, there's like a really important ways that we inoculated the event right from the get-go that prevented it from being colonized by any particular political agenda or political organization, either in San Francisco or elsewhere, as it turns out. And different factions of people, of course, made it their own, and different ways people have sort of appropriated it in various places. But it has a remarkable resiliency and ability to sort of resist the normal paradigms that our political lives and our social lives tend to impose. One other little bit of prehistory that I want to quickly run through, and it came clear 10 years later, I was doing this book, Critical Mass, Bicycling's Defiant Celebration, which I still have a few copies of if you're interested. And we got stuff from all over the world. And one of the interesting articles we got was from a guy that lives in the East Bay named Hank Chapeau, which was about this enormous bicycling movement in the United States in the 1890s. And San Francisco, of course, had a giant bicycling movement in that period of time, too, and it was demanding asphalt and good roads. And so there's a great irony to thinking back on that 100 years earlier as we now embrace the bicycle as an ecological device and a way of transforming cities, that actually the bicycle already had a pretty big impact on transforming cities and wasn't altogether what we might have dreamed of if we were doing it today. There are also a number of specific initiatives that preceded our time doing critical mass, which are very important precursors. There was a big rise in the late early 70s in New York and in Berkeley and many other cities demanding, you know, better access for bicycles to the streets and more space for bicycling. And that's what led to that first round of those little green bike route signs that you can still see in many cities in the United States. And of course, mostly were never fully carried out or and left to just become moribund. There were also people organizing in the Bay Area around Bay Area Bicycle Action and trying to create a Golden Gate Park free of cars and open to bicycles and pedestrians. That's an ongoing effort in the city. It hasn't stopped. And, of course, the first Gulf War brought lots of people out on bicycles and were protesting. And in fact, a group of people rode up from Santa Cruz, about 60 strong, to protest the Gulf War. And Jim Denovan came one day, who was one of the people, and asked me if that was maybe where we got the idea for critical mass. And I had to say, well, no, I'm sorry, we didn't really even know. I didn't, and I don't know if anybody else did know about that. You know, I don't think it's an idea that I had. I think it's an idea that was already in everybody's head, the obvious thing, ride home together. So we started off with that premise, and you know, there's ways that we got away with it for a while in San Francisco because nobody knew we were doing it. The cops paid no attention to it until the following April. By then, we were actually several hundred strong in the streets, and it was pretty unstoppable. We had a policy, unlike some of the things that are being advocated in other talks today, of not talking to the media. We thought that's not our problem. They could come and chase us around if they're interested, but we don't really care about that. We don't believe in the model of the 10-second soundbite or the one, you know, half a sentence paragraph quote in the local paper. It just didn't matter to us. We sort of saw what we were doing as making a step towards improving our lives very directly and in the here and now. And it started off that way. And then there was, of course, as there has been in many cities, a group of us who were more involved than other people in helping determine the tone of the event. I had a big role. I wrote lots and lots of words, and people still are laughing about how many things I wrote and how long-winded they were back in the day. But those flyers had some pretty strong influence and went floating around the world and still have an influence on how people shape their ideas about how this event should go. And so the idea that there's no leaders, that it's an organized coincidence, which is an interesting kind of combination of words when you stop and think about it, because it's an oxymoron. I mean, how could you have an organized coincidence? Well, that's exactly why it works, because it does have enough organization that it can keep happening and hold its coherence as an experience of rolling through the streets en masse in a large group of people that are actually transforming life as they do it. And so that vision has inspired a lot of people to participate in it. And so for those of us at the early days of San Francisco's critical mass, who became, to our own dismay, something of a secret cabal of about, I don't know, couple, maybe a dozen and a half people who were having way more influence than anybody else. We had invented all these concepts. They weren't really new ideas, like xerocracy, for instance, in which anybody could be a xerocrat. Go get your Xerox machine at work and start making copies if you're a xerocrat and get your ideas out. And that's still available to all of us at all times. You know, anybody can use the common technologies that we have for communication. And it really helped to make it open to anybody to do that. And so that was true, but it was also true that there weren't very many of us doing it. And those of us who were tended to do it week after, or month after month, for the first 2.5 years, as I've seen reproduced in other cities over time, as people start critical masses in other cities, they very often have a group who are wearing the same t-shirts and are kind of taking care of it, kind of helping it. And I think that's fine, but it's also interesting if you can kind of let go of that and move away. So in the early evolution of critical mass in San Francisco in 1995, those of us that had been in this role decided to announce that we were stopping, and we just totally stopped. And up until then, we'd been producing a little newsletter every month called the Critical Mass Missives. Very often had a proposed route on it. We were very interested in promoting the idea that we should be responsible for the routes and make them enjoyable excursions through the city where you would see the city in a new way, in a new light, move into parts of the city you may not even know you could bicycle in or not, just weren't familiar with, and to really sort of share the experience with a broader and broader part of the population. And it really worked incredibly well to do that because it gave you this creative relationship to the urban geography that you may not have had if you just stuck to the same route month after month and kept doing the same thing. Of course, what happened also is that there became something of a weird little tussle over the route. Suddenly it was a point of power struggle. Who's going to get the route this time? And so very rarely did more than one route proposal show up, and it was never a guarantee that it would be followed, and very often it wasn't followed closely. But often enough it was followed in general. But by the time we withdrew, there was this one guy floating around the scene who was a little bit of a slightly deranged man. And I've been around before. And it's unpleasant. And part of the interesting problem of creating open, radical initiatives in our culture is that it attracts people who are lonely and slightly insane. And they want to be part of it. And, you know, I get it. I would want to be part of it if I was in that situation, too. And I don't want to exclude people just for those reasons. But if they can't behave in a way that gets along with everybody, you have a big problem on your hands, so you have to figure out something to exclude them. So we ended up having another group of people showed up to help shape critical mass during that time. And we pushed this guy out of the picture because he was trying to take over and make posters and giant routes, and there were always these 35-mile rides every time, and it was about speeding through the city. And it was just completely opposite to the culture that we wanted, which was slow, convivial, human-centered, reoccupying the city on a new basis, etc. So I'm just skirting over tons of details and tons of information.
Get your papers, like, because I think, you know, while that movement was growing, there was another kind of quiet trend that was going on with more average bicyclists starting to be drawn to some of these issues. I think Dave Snyder's got some a presentation on that.
Yeah, sure do. And at first I just want to talk a little bit and tell the story of the early days of the Bike Coalition, which doesn't need a slideshow. You can back up on the slide.
Watch out for the wire.
I tell my personal story because I think it's relevant to the point that I want to make. I was the executive director of the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition from 1991 to 2002. I moved to San Francisco in 1989, and I wanted to be an activist. That's all I knew, is that I wanted to be an activist. I took a job as a secretary for a foundation that gave away money to peace groups, and was involved in some Central America solidarity work, and I thought that was all cool. There were a bunch of anarchists in town who were organizing these bike rides throughout the city. And on Earth Day in 1990, they had the Earth Day Bicycle Parade. And I had an epiphany, literally, on that ride. I thought, oh, my God, I could be a bicycle activist. And that's a way to fight U.S. imperialism, to help the United States be less of a bad actor in the world because of our oil dependence, and help my own community and my own people because the Central America work that I was doing didn't seem so satisfying. The people in Central America had no idea what I was doing, and I probably wasn't being very helpful anyway, you know? And so I thought, cool, I can be selfish and responsible at the same time. And so I thought that's what I'll do. So what am I going to do? I'll publish a newsletter. The reason I wanted to publish the newsletter was because I knew these anarchists who were doing all this great direct action in the streets, and they would complain about how nobody in the city paid them any mind whatsoever. And then I also knew, through separate channels, the people who are part of the Bicycle Transportation Advisory Committee. They were bureaucrats appointed by, or at this point they were self-appointed, but they would meet with the Department of Parking and Traffic and have very bureaucratic meetings asking for this little improvement or that little improvement. And they would complain that there was nobody in the streets to back them up. And I thought, you people need to talk. You need to know that each other exists. And I talked to the then executive director of the Bicycle Coalition, Daryl Skrabach. It was really a one-person organization. He was keeping the bills paid in the P.O. box, and that's about it. If I could use the name of his organization for the newsletter, and he said, sure, and that's how it started. And it grew pretty quickly from then. I want to now talk about how the San Francisco Bike Coalition grew, how it is parallel to the movement around the country, all over the country, and explain how I think that the bicycle movement is a mature movement. It's a strong movement. It's no longer in the beginning days. This movement is very strong, and I think we have a responsibility now to leverage that strength for a bigger cause. And I have a few charts and whatnot to illustrate. Oh, that's the which was the last one. All right, so...
Hey, pardon me. Is it possible to angle that projector a little higher? Like, it's hard to see over the head.
How's that?
I was able to do what I did. I had a lot of, you know, ability to talk to bureaucrats and whatnot as a middle class guy with a college education, able to work for free basically as a volunteer executive director because I didn't have even college bills to pay. I had a lot of luxury and a lot of privilege to be able to do that, and I think that is an important fact. The Bike Coalition grew from a handful of members in 1990 to around 4,000 in 2002, and now it's dang close to 9,000. Yeah, dang close to 10,000. And that parallels what you see throughout the country. In 1996, there were a grand total of 12 full-time equivalent people working on the bike movement. And in 2006, it was 194 full-time employees. I suspect it's closer to 300 in 2008. In the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, there are over 20 staff people working on a variety of different bicycle coalitions. The movement is significant. Yeah, hit it. if you look at bicycle activism on Google, you get 3,870 hits. Do transit activism, you get 400 hits. Do car free activism, you get 230 hits. The bicycle movement is where it's at in terms of community organizing. Why is that? Why is the bicycle movement so strong in transit, which carries so many more people than bicycling, so weak? Well, I think it's because of the kind of people who ride bikes, and let's be honest about that. Sorry, I don't have fancy charts, but you can see for yourself. Bicycling is more male than female. And here in Portland, because of the improvements you've made, I think you've closed that gender gap a bit. But in the United States, this is a Bay Area chart, three times more men than women bike.
It's still unfortunately true in Portland.
Yeah, that's... a huge factor, I think. And what that means is that the people who bike have more power. This next chart here is a wage gap chart between males and females in the current United States. The shorter bars are females, the larger bars are males. So you look at those two charts together, and that tells you something about the power of the bike movement and our ability to organize richer people. Hit the next one. The next thing has to do with racial privilege. These are pictures of the leaders of bicycle organizations from various Thunderhead Alliance retreats. This is the cream of the crop. These are awesome people. I love these people. This is so fun. These are people who had the gumption to start bicycle organizations when there wasn't much there. They're very talented organizers, and they are to us person white, every last one of them. This is that's a telling fact because this is a chart of But yeah, this is that same chart. This is the national chart of bicycle commuting. Or sorry, this is that data put into a chart format. The next one. All right. Well, these aren't in perfect order, but this is a chart that shows the amount of money from the federal transportation bill that we've gotten as a bicycle movement from 1988 to the year 2009. Those are millions of dollars. In 1988, it was like a few million dollars for bicyclists out of the federal transportation bill. In the last, we're looking at $500-600 million a year from the U.S. government for bicycling. In the last round of the federal transportation bill, there were earmarks galore for bicycling. I mean, we know how to work the system. Oops.
I'm going to go back.
Yeah, I want to go back to that one, yeah. Thank you. Now, that's bicycling. It's a white male thing. This is car freeness. I don't have a gender chart on it, but... whites are also, they drive more than every group. So the car-free movement is not a white movement. The bicycle movement is a white movement. Most of us around here are bicyclists. That's what brings us to this conference. I'm really interested in learning what we can do as bicycle movements to leverage our power and accept the fact that we are a mature movement and move beyond just bicycling, because I think to a large part, we've won that one, and we need to figure out how to extend beyond bicycling to the larger car-free movement, which of course is going to include bicycling way more than it already does. I think some groups in some cities are doing well. Transportation Alternatives, Chicago, San Francisco, we all have organizations that look just beyond bikes, but I think we have a few big tests coming up, and I think that we have had a history of selling out the car-free movement to promote bikes. In every single federal transportation bill, we get more money, motoring gets more money. Transit doesn't necessarily get more money. We supported the federal transportation bill, even though it was a very car-full bill. Locally, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, I've learned, doesn't support the Columbia River crossing, but they don't oppose it either. They have a nuanced, subtle position that doesn't come out and strongly say that they oppose that bridge. It's a huge amount of money. Anyway.
So why does it matter that the bike movement is growing strong, the car-free movement is growing strong? It's largely because politics matters when it comes to car-free politics, because this is largely a struggle for space in the big cities. That's the area where Jason Henderson has done a lot of his research.
Okay, so I am a geography professor, and my research interest is in how cities are contested, and particularly how the transportation is contested, what I call the politics of mobility. I originally did my dissertation and some subsequent research on the sprawl debate in Atlanta, Georgia, so I'm very familiar with the automobile culture, and as I was doing that research, I got very interested in the ideologies and values that undergird why people engage in a local transportation debate. One thing that I want to preface is that in the United States, unlike Europe, even though we have a federal transportation policy and a federal highway administration and whatnot, the decisions are made locally. So in the United States, local politics really matters. And that's not just transportation, but it's also zoning of land uses, which is a critical component of thinking about transportation. So what I want to do is just briefly talk about map the landscape of San Francisco's politics of mobility, which I think you'll find there are similarities in American cities throughout the United States, but perhaps the world. Now, I want to just say that as I discuss the three broad camps that have a sort of political agenda in transportation politics, I want to emphasize that that doesn't mean that those are the only exclusive participants. There are a lot of people who engage in the politics of mobility indirectly and don't have a voice or don't articulate a position. So what I'm looking at here is who shows up at City Hall. That's what I'm looking at. So, there's no data on, how many people would fit in progressive, neoliberal, or neoconservative. But I just want to emphasize that, yes, there are, probably a whole bunch more nuanced views. But this is who shows up. in San Francisco and in Atlanta and probably in Portland, and you could probably look at this throughout the United States. Now, I want to first start with progressives. Dave was talking about how to expand the movement. Progressives, political progressives, you know, sort of the left, if you will, enter into transportation debates with a motivation or concern about the environment or social justice. And the sort of vision that is articulated is that it's time to slow down, that we're rapidly depleting the Earth's resources, and that speeding up in everyday life and forcing people to work these low-wage jobs, longer hours, and so on and so forth. This all gets kind of bundled together into sort of a vision of slowing down and reducing consumption. But what makes progressives distinctive in the political realm is that they strongly believe that the government has a role in regulating the urban landscape in such a way that it reduces the use of the automobile, that it constrains automobility, that you know, through zoning policies, we have things like parking regulations that say, you know, there's going to be less parking. And so in San Francisco, you have a very aggressive, progressive movement that has a well-articulated and well-framed argument that the government, whether it be the local, the state, or the federal government, has a direct role to play in our mobility decisions, in how society organizes itself. And so anyway, this is a slide of a group of neighborhood activists in what's called the San Jose Guerrero Corridor, which I thought was a really a good example of a group of progressives that believe that the high-speed traffic through their neighborhood is a problem. Now, what's interesting about progressives is that they're also kind of, and I'll say this, I don't think my friends here are expecting this, but they're kind of confused because they don't want to attack capitalism because that's not cool in America, and you lose legitimacy in political discourse. Look at Obama right now.
Paper attacks capitalism.
Your paper does. But when you want to slow down, when you argue about slowing down, what you're arguing ultimately is that the exchange of commodities, the flows, you're sort of challenging the accumulation process of capital. And, you know, a lot of progressives understand that, but in the discourse you're not going to hear smash the state or a direct challenge to capitalism. So it's a little confusing, and what makes it interesting in San Francisco is that progressives have wedded with this idea of pricing. And pricing is a very neoliberal idea. And, of course, it depends on how you use pricing. But the neoliberal vision of the city is an ambivalent vision. It is a vision that that what you do is you use price to determine what the outcome will be. You don't have a preconceived vision of how the city should be organized, but it's just the market. Let the market decide. Let the highest bidder decide on what the best use is. Or if you're making a transportation decision, are you willing to pay or are you not? And that's sort of the high theory of neoliberalism. And what's interesting in San Francisco and in New York and other parts of the country is that this idea of pricing has become this progressive idea. But what I want to do is just sort of parse it out a little bit, because it's very important to understand, and I know most of you have come up against this, but it splits the progressive community, because the working class, the outer boroughs, if you will, of San Francisco, where the rent-controlled tenants live, they have sort of a resistance to pricing, because they're saying, hey, you know, only the Lexus drivers and the Mercedes drivers are going to be able to drive to downtown. Why can't I? So it's just a nuance. And I know we could go all day on that, but it's important to kind of understand that that's a sort of, I want to sort of separate it out from the progressive vision. Now, the one that we're all the most familiar with, and you know, everybody knows Don Shoup, and I respect his work, and I actually personally support some methods of pricing depending on how you use it, but I'm just sort of separating out. But you can see it's a way of allocating the space. That's the central entry point of the neoliberal perspective in transportation. Now, lastly, in San Francisco, there is what I call a neoconservative argument. Now, what's interesting about this neoconservative angle is that even, say, gays will embrace in a neoconservative argument about transportation. Now, they might not be voting for Bush or Cheney, but when you engage in local politics, what a lot of people who see themselves maybe as progressive on social issues will say in a local transportation debate is, I want to protect a certain set of social relations, which is the heart of the conservative idea. and that I want to use government to protect that set of social relations. And so the conservative argument is that the government should provide parking, that the government should provide the road space, that's the duty of government. So interestingly, progressives and conservatives have something big in common, which is using the government to achieve their vision. But conservatives have obviously a very different vision of the city. And in San Francisco, in parking debates, in the debates about removing a car lane in order to have a bike lane, if you go to a local public hearing, you'll hear family values. I can't have a family without a car. And it goes into this whole, if you follow the logic, it goes into this whole neoconservative idea about the world and how the world operates, and the government must provide cheap parking, cheap automobility in order for me to bring my kids to school. And that's the most common place where it shows up. Another thread of this is in the merchant class, where the small business owners will say, well, my business has to have parking and it has to be free, and you can't start putting congestion pricing in or pricing or whatever. And so what's interesting is, you know, I just wanted to sort of parse this out, is that, you know, you get this geography in San Francisco where you got the pointer? Or should I just go over to the screen? Right. So the pointer. So this side of the city is sort of the bastion of the neoconservative argument. And as the Bicycle Coalition or other organizations push for government intervention to reduce automobility, in the local city politics, this side of town, which has its own representatives in the city hall, are a strong, formidable force, and they engage in a rhetoric that's very neoconservative. Now, they vote Democrat, and I think that it's important to mention that. But when it comes to these local transportation debates, they have a conservative ideology. So that's where I'm coming from with that. Out here, you've got a very working class element in San Francisco politics, which is very suspicious of the neoliberal angle of pricing. And yet on things like wage issues or healthcare issues and so on and so forth, they'll ally with the progressives in the center of the city on those issues. But when it comes to transportation and transportation reform, you get these fissures. And it's over this sort of neoliberal vision of pricing. So you get a geography in the city that shows up. But, you know, it's, of course, much more nuanced than that. And I just want to emphasize that those are three broad visions that are articulated in local politics, and those are the people that show up. So that's what we have to work from, especially as a scholar. You know, you can't just make things up. You have to have evidence. So I think Dave's point about getting more people involved but also making those bridges is one of the fundamental challenges. And I'll just end with the fundamental challenge in San Francisco and probably in Portland and everywhere else is affordable housing to bridge that gap. Because, you know, it's great to make a walkable neighborhood. I've been involved in creating one. And now, basically, if I tried to enter into that neighborhood, I couldn't afford to live there. So the housing question is going to be fundamental to this. So I'll just pass the bat.
So this is the sort of context of the battle here. We've got the, like, you know, radicals over there that are on the streets that are pushing the envelope. We have an organizational structure being set up in this playing field. And now Leah, you know, came on, you know, took over the Bike Coalition at an interesting time when there was a mayor that was open to some of these ideas, not others. And we're still kind of having this battle for space. And she's played a role both in the Bike Coalition. She's also served. She also served a couple of years on the Metropolitan Transportation Agency, which is in charge of Muni and whatnot. So she's presided over this sort of broadening of the bike movement into more car-free concepts in general. So you can talk about that.
Yeah. I'll just say that I think piggybacking off Dave sharing his personal story of how I got involved with this, I think mine is telling as well. I moved to San Francisco in about 1994. Thought, oh, I'm moving from suburban Florida to San Francisco, this dense, transit-friendly city. I'm going to leave my Honda back in Florida. I'm going to leave that with my family. I'm going to head out west. I came out there to find a pretty unworkable transit system, not a great transit system in the early 90s, if you know much about San Francisco. I was really frustrated. I tried to give transit a chance. but I was working late night in a restaurant. It was really hard. So I borrowed this rickety old bike from a roommate. I biked a little bit in Florida, but not much. Suburban Florida, not so great biking. So I started riding around San Francisco out of pure necessity. I had nothing political or social or anything on my mind other than pure necessity. And a couple of times, I was fortunate enough to literally run into critical mass. I mean, not run into, but run by critical mass. And think, wow, what's that? What are all those bicycles doing? And then I started to notice kind of how lonely I felt out there biking. I was once run off the road onto a sidewalk, and I started to think about my biking experience a little bit. And then I was very lucky one day to be in a coffee shop after work, and I was literally eavesdropping. Watch out for me, I'll eavesdrop on anybody around. Get my coffee, waiting in line, and I hear these people talking about biking, and they all sound really pissed off, and it's about six guys, I think it was all guys, about six white guys, sitting at a table at the coffee shop, and I waited until there was a pause, and I walked over, I said, hey, what are you doing? And next thing I know, I'm editing their newsletter, literally. They didn't know me from Adam. I'm writing a story, they're like, oh, you're pretty good, why don't you edit our newsletter, you know, 10 hours a week for free. I said, sure. So that was my entree into San Francisco. But I really did, my awakening, you know, built off of these folks' work, so I commend them to begin with. So a little bit about San Francisco. It's a little fuzzy, but this is a front page article in the San Francisco Chronicle that ran about a year ago, and we were pretty excited about that headline. And I think for the most part it's pretty true. I think San Francisco is definitely one of the leaders of bicycle advocacy in the country. We definitely have one of the best bicycling cultures. I mean, anybody who's been out there knows it's beautiful, lovely riding, a lot of recreational biking interests, a lot of history, of course, with mountain biking and such, and just a lot of enthusiasm over biking. But what we're trying to do is make bicycling a regular mainstream part of transportation. So to let you know a little bit about the Bicycle Coalition, our goal is specifically promoting the bicycle for everyday transportation. Not that we don't care about your recreational rides, but we're really focused on transportation, and that's where we want to make the progress. This is a picture from Bike to Work Day this year. This was May, a Thursday morning. Love it. Maybe Dave could point out one of our supervisors who bikes every day with a white helmet in front. Oh, thank you.
Progressive.
We've got an 11-member board of supervisors. We have a veto-proof majority of bike supporters on that board of supervisors. Again, this guy on the board rides pretty much every day to work, which is great. We don't have as friendly of a mayor. I might hit on that in a minute. And that's where some of our roadblocks come up. So talk a little bit about the scene in San Francisco. We commissioned a poll last November, so pretty recent data of San Francisco adults. This was actually just voters, so I think this is fairly conservative because it's not counting non-voters, registered voters. So 4% of San Francisco adults say they bike daily. They were asked, what's your mode? Daily bicyclists. That's a lot of people. That's 30,000. The next question was, do you bike at least once a week? That was 12% on top of that. Put these together, it's 120,000 people. That's a lot of people biking. We were really encouraged by that number. We also asked the question, do you want to bike? Would you bicycle for transportation? Again, this was about biking for transportation. 33% yes said, yeah, they would. And what was exciting to me is that number's pretty big. That's a big pool to work from. But also, what were the things that were keeping them, inhibiting them from riding? It was all stuff we can fix. It was feeling safer on the road. It was better bike parking, more secure bike parking. It was understanding how to get around hills. It wasn't anything we can't do as advocates, which is really great. It wasn't, I hate biking, and, you know, I'm never going to be able to and such. And I want to point out, you know, our goal at the Bike Coalition is not to pull every single person out of their car or off the bus to ride a bike. We want to make the city wonderful, comfortable, safe for everyone who wants to ride a bike. And I'm pretty sure that number is even bigger than that. So our goal at the Bike Coalition, again, I said that's 16% are biking at least once a week. Our goal at the Bike Coalition is to get 25% of what we call regular bicyclists, people who are biking at least once a week, hopefully more often, but at least once a week by the year 2012. This is a shot of Market Street. Maybe I won't do that right now. Yeah, I'm joking. But we've got a very motivated community in San Francisco. People get it, and I want to point out that the reason I do this work, and I know a lot of us do this work, the reason I think most of our folks are members is not because they love the bicycle so much. I do. I love my bike. It's great. It's fun. It's lovely to ride. But we do it because we love the city. There really is an ethos within the coalition that we're doing this for the bigger cause, whether that be, you know, the environment, the health, the congestion issues. But it really is because we want to make a difference in the place we're in. And the biking is the means to an end there, not the end in and of itself. This is a picture from Bike to Work Day this past May. We held a press conference out in front of City Hall. Again, so we had 11 members of the Board of Supervisors, 8 of them rode into work with us that day. So we had 8 folks biking from their homes to their workplace at City Hall. And to me, that's a really important way to get our city leaders, decision makers to understand. And we kind of wanted to illustrate some of the benefits to biking, in case they weren't familiar with that. This is our president of the Board of Supervisors talking here. He once rode across the country. Another shot is out on Valencia Street, one of the biggest places for biking and one of the Bike Coalition's earliest victories. Let me kind of jump back here. Yeah.
San Francisco is hardly like kumbaya biking time. There's real divisions that carry forth this day. As we said, the mayor has been a bit of a barrier. We're dealing with a bike injunction. And a lot of these divisions kind of go back to the 1 year of the big conflict in San Francisco biking that is still rippling out today in all kinds of ways. And that's 1997. And Chris can talk a little bit about what happened then and how it's influencing the debate today.
Well, in 1997, we had Willie Brown as our mayor, and he had been, I think, reelected at that point. He was still in his first term, but he was working out some kind of secret deal, real estate shenanigans. And during the summer of 97, it was June, I believe, he apparently got stuck in his limousine. He was basically chauffeured around in a limo routinely throughout his time as a mayor. He's somewhat blind, so he probably needed to get a driver. But
though he did also bicycle with us all 8 years of his term. So I just want to point
sort
that out.
Sort of. I don't know if I call that bicycling. But anyway, the tension between the radical side and
anyway, so Willie Brown was up to no good as usual. And his basic policy was to pour as much cement in town as he could, which had a strong support of organized labor, of course, and to build as many things as he could build, and really no concern whatsoever for the quality of life on the streets of the city. And in 1990, we had huge rise in 96, in the summer of 96, like 4,000 or 5,000 people started showing up with critical mass on a couple of those. And so we had this experience of the ride just becoming this incredible, unwieldy, chaotic, crazy time. It was actually quite fun. And in June, it was pretty big, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000, and he apparently got stuck and he got mad. And then I think he had his own reasons for making a big publicity storm about it. So he started making all these blustering threats. And came July, he was saying he was going to shut it down, and there's all this stuff going on. And they called me personally and a few other people that they tried to track down who might be the leaders to come to a meeting, and most of us refused to go. And so I have nothing to talk about with them. Why would I go and talk to the mayor and the politicians? Just get out of the way. Just leave us alone and let us carry on. And that had been the strategy that we'd had all from the beginning, was to ignore the police entirely, never talk to them. Ignore the media, don't talk to them unless they come on the ride first, and then if they want to have a discussion, they should talk about it. And so Willie wants somebody to come into a closed room where he can make a deal. That's how his political operation works, is to make deals. And I knew this. I mean, I'm not young, so I know about this. So I advise everybody not to go in. But some of the Bike Coalition board members decided to go in and have a discussion with Michael Yockey, who was his kind of yes man on the board at the time. And they came out, and they didn't make any agreements with him, but Yockey came out like Neville Chamberlain waving a piece of paper saying, okay, a deal's been done, and we'll now have peace on the streets in July's critical mass. And the Chronicle dutifully publishes a map that they've approved with the police department, and we're all going, what the hell? And so we plan to show up and just, like, no way. We're not going along with any of their plans at all, and they're in for a big surprise if they think they're going to control us. So we get down there, and it's all in Ted White's documentary, so if you haven't seen that, I highly recommend it. So we get down to the foot of Market Street where we start, and there's the police department set up a stage with a microphone, and they're like welcoming us to our ride, and we're like, what the fuck is going on? And then Willie Brown shows up, and so we all start booing and jeering him and really giving him a hard time. And he tries to make his speech through this incredible wave of animosity coming from most of us who are standing around him. There was a lot of people who grabbed the mic before he spoke and different things were said. And finally, we finally got moving and we went in every direction at once. Like, just so many bicycles had assembled. It was, over 5,000, maybe up to, some people think it was 10. Nobody knows. But it was mass chaos throughout San Francisco for the next 3 hours. And there was helicopter, footage about, critical mass is turning to critical mess. And, there's the same cliches over and over again. And it was really hysterical. And it was like, okay, well, that's what happens. And so some people thought, well, you need to have your media team ready to go and counteract their message. And most of us, my position was, no, we should just lay low. It'll blow over. And sure enough, it did. And the next month, we showed back up and we did the good soldier strike routine, which is like, okay, you want us to obey the law? Fine. We'll obey all the laws, precisely. And of course, that was a much bigger mess. So you had thousands of bicyclists who were going single file and occupying all the lanes and putting their foot down at every light and everything else, and it made it a much bigger mess. And they backed off from there. They actually stopped repressing it. But from that point forward, the police started having a more tolerant attitude. The internal organization of critical mass became much more inchoate and unfocused. Like, everybody just kind of said, okay, we kind of kept it going. Now we don't have to worry about it. It just takes care of itself. And for years beyond that, it has done so in terms of critical mass experience. And it's interesting to hear my colleagues on the board, and we're all good friends, and it's fine, but people don't show up at City Hall. They don't. Most people that are interesting, doing interesting work around changing life in the streets of San Francisco, think the city government is an impediment and an obstacle and not worth dealing with. It's just it's like a big sponge. And if you go down there and get involved in their commissions or their public commentaries, you're just like giving them your energy for no end. They don't listen to you. They don't change anything that they're going to do based on your showing up and making comments.
Yeah, we also have to deal with City Hall, and it was Davey's job at that point to be trying to take something out of this mess and move the movement forward. I'd like to hear both Lee and Dave talk a little bit about how critical mass has been both a boon and hindrance to winning some of your goals.
You can imagine how it's a hindrance, and I'd rather not go into that because it's easy to explain, and I think that on balance it was a benefit. Just to go back to 97, 98, I was out of town during the negotiations about critical mass. It was a messed up time. But we were asked, so what do you guys want? And we said, well, since you're asking, we got nothing to do with critical mass, but since you're asking, we want the bike network. And we actually made a strategic decision to ask for way more than we thought we could get. And the mayor agreed to have hearings on it, knowing it had to give us something. And we asked for 8 bike lanes on streets where, in every single case, they would have to take out traffic lanes to give us bike lanes. And we ended up getting like 2.5, I think, out of that 8. Do you remember? Something like that, yeah. We would not have gotten that without critical mass. So the fact that we were able to leverage all that stuff in the streets, I even had the aide to Michael Yaki tell me, you know, the only reason you're getting this attention is because you have 5,000 people in the streets. So, well, I don't have them, but that's cool.
I'll just add, I mean, I think it's the quintessential inside-outside thing. You know, not that you plan it per se, but it is what it is. I think it works brilliantly. You know, we are the ones that turn people out to City Hall, and that means now we turn out enough people again. We have 9,500 members now. And not just are they members, they're unusually active. These are the people who take the time for whatever We Bike Advocates, take the time to write letters, show up at things. I think it does make a difference because the day after our new Board of Supervisors gets elected, I get calls from about half of them saying, what do you guys want? We don't even have to place the calls now. Now, I'm not saying that's all you need to do by any means, but building that strength sets you up for getting their ear. You then got to keep doing the work of working with the community groups, setting out the vision, keeping turning people out. You can't stop, obviously, but I think it's all about the numbers.
And her numbers for the organization now hitting, you're pushing 10,000, right? That was a lot of these high-profile Bike to Work Day critical mass events, which I know Jason has actually used critical mass as his teaching tool for his students.
I do a bicycle field trip in September for my transportation class, and I take the class around the city and point out both the good and the bad with bicycling, show them techniques, have a little safety, talk about infrastructure. At 5:30 to 6, we end at the starting point of critical mass, where I tell them that the field trip's over. The university is not responsible for any activity that occurs from this point forward. And the waiver that you signed said that the field trip ended at 6. And so, and the students always come back the next Monday or Tuesday, and they're like, yeah, that, you know, these are mostly suburban students who have never experienced critical mass. And it's amazing even in the Bay Area that they, you know, never did it or never heard of it even because the media doesn't really cover it. And so they do it, and they're blown away by it even if they've never ridden a bike. I get a lot of them that borrow the bike or pull it out of the garage and do it, and I think it's extremely effective. And some of them go back.
And we should probably also mention, too, that it's not just about bikes. As Dave said, you know, this is a movement that is growing more and more into the car-free realms, and in fact, we are now possibly going to be the first city in the U.S. to do congestion pricing. There's a big study on that coming out next week. And Dave, I think you can talk a little bit about congestion pricing.
Sure.
That's the title of our talk.
You represent the neoliberal organization.
Yeah, I do. congestion pricing is, you all know the theory what it is. Well, there's two versions of congestion pricing that we're talking about in San Francisco. One is a very modest congestion-related pricing of the Golden Gate Bridge, which already has a toll. I think it's $5 now, and they're talking about making it 7 at peak and 6 off peak. But it's not new road pricing at all, and it's not any kind of new technology or anything. It's simply raising the toll with some attention paid to peak and off-peak differentials. The other thing that we are looking at is more a kind of London, Stockholm, what they were talking about in New York, congestion pricing plan that's a lot more serious, drawing a cordon around the downtown, perhaps, tolling the gateways into the city. Just like in New York, that would require state legislative approval. The plan is due in a few months, and we'll need to have local support from New York to get
to so be this area.
That's one of the ideas. They're talking about that. They're also talking about the gateway. San Francisco has a pretty neat way to toll entrance into the city. From the entire East Bay, you've got one bridge here. From the entire North Bay, you've got one bridge here. And on the southern border, there's really not a lot of roads. This residential neighborhood kind of peters out. You've got this road, you've got this highway, you've got this highway and a couple of roads over here, and that's it. So you could theoretically toll every entrance into the city. So that's one of the options that we're talking about.
And this is something
frankly, I don't give ourselves much of a chance with this governor. I don't think this governor will sign a bill.
But our mayor's come around on this, and it looks like Gavin Newsom, he talks a lot about it. He's also pushing this variable pricing thing. But we should probably also mention, are we going to mention the injunction?
Yeah.
Okay. We're also, for all of our advances in San Francisco, we're in the unusual position of being barred by the courts from doing any new bike improvements, which includes everything from lanes to bike racks. And that stemmed from unusual kind of situation with the environmental laws in California.
It's kind of insane. Two individuals, and I literally mean that, two individuals were able to use the state's environmental law, wonderfully written and intended back 30 years ago, but now being wildly perverted by lots of NIMBYs who want to just stop projects. So these two individuals 2 years ago sued the city, said the bike plan didn't go through proper environmental review. I could go on for hours about maybe technically it didn't, but I could go on and on. But unfortunately, the judge agreed and said, yeah, city of San Francisco, you have to stop everything. So 2 years ago, freeze on the city. It's pretty insane. I will say, looking forward, spring of next year is when this is supposed to be lifted. The silver lining here is that in these 2.5 years, the city's been studying about 50-plus bike network improvements. Most of these are road diets. Most of these are taking traffic lanes out and adding bike lanes. Some are just major intersection improvements. But never before in San Francisco's history have we had 50 projects looked at a time. In a way, these people are helping us. I mean, don't let that get out of the room. But, I mean, we're very frustrated by it. But never, sadly, would our bureaucracy have gotten its butt in gear to do 50 projects over 2 years. I wish I could say they would have, but they wouldn't have. So that's a strange way that we're actually getting more done. I will say real quickly, though, even though there's been this freeze in the last 2 years of no new physical improvements, actually the numbers have jumped significantly. City count from last year to this year of bicyclists on weekdays, major transportation corridors in the city, up 15%. And again, that's with no new improvements on the street. So that's encouraging.
We're going to throw this open for questions in just a second. Before we do, we're going to let the last word go to our most provocative panelists so we can kick it off in the discussion.
Chris? Well, I just wanted to go back to this point about bicycling and critical mass, and the point that was made a minute ago, too, is that critical mass is not really only or exclusively or narrowly about bicycling. It never was. It was really about public space. It's about a different way of living together in urban environments. It's about re-inhabiting the city in a more broad and thoroughgoing way. It's really about opening up the chance to have a conversation with strangers where you aren't buying a service. first, or a drink, or listening to some pounding music, or whatever. And so being able to really re-inhabit the city from, on this basis, it implies much more than just bicycling, or even just car-free. Although those are embedded in the, into that dialogue, for sure. But we have to go a lot deeper than that. And I thought Peñalosa's big speech a couple of days ago was kind of interesting, because he was so clear about arguing for a starting point, which is a little bit of a permacultural sensibility, is to back up and ask yourselves, how do you want to live? And that's really what we were doing when we were doing Critical Mass from the very beginning. A lot of us were in that conversation. It's like, we need to find a place to begin the process of changing how we live, and riding together in the streets in an organized coincidence and going home together once a month was a way to start a process of opening new communities and new networks of knowing each other and trusting each other and beginning to take action in the real world together. And Peñalosa's other point that I thought was really well taken and actually very informative for the San Francisco situation was that the kind of bike lanes that we're getting are horribly inadequate. And this has been an argument I've been making since the late 80s, is that we should be having these beautiful horticulturally designed side paths that really alter how the streets are used and look at the streets as our remaining commons, and that half the streets could be growing food instead of housing private automobiles. And we're not very forceful, frankly. And I feel like the advocacy in San Francisco has accepted the narrowness of what's allowed, which are painted stripes on the streets. And we should. I mean, right now, Valencia Street's getting this thing. That's our favorite street in San Francisco for bicycling. It's by far the most popular bike corridor. And it has bike lanes for a number of years now, thanks to the hard work of some of the coalition folks. But now we're going through this great streets transition, and I once again dragged myself to a public hearing to make my argument. Like, this is the time. We're redesigning the street. Can't we talk about a Copenhagen model? You know, sidewalk, curb, bikeway, curb, then the cars shoved off to the middle. And everybody looked at me like I was crazy. And they just like, that's too late. We can't bring that in. And they won't go for it. And I'm just like, wait a minute. Why? And so we just don't even ask for the minimal thing we should be asking for, even in a ridiculous capitalist society. And what we really need to be talking about, I mean, what's really deeply at stake here is not just how we live, but what do we do? And what we do is we reproduce a mad world with our labor every day. And so getting to that job is one of the issues. How do we get there? But why are we going to these jobs? Why are we doing all that work when it's just ruining ourselves and ruining the world? And that conversation is deeply embedded in the logic of critical mass. And finally, it's deeply embedded in the logic of bicycling in cities, even if we don't very often bring it up. So I had to bring it up.
That's what I'm talking about. All right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure.
I just want to start by appreciating all of you. I think my opinion is that moment in, what was it, 97, when Willie Brown chaired the Critical Mass was really pivotal, certainly for our area in Northern California, but also, I think, for the whole country. I mean, I was leading kids on backpacking trips. I rearranged the entire backpacking schedule of the little kiddies so I could ride 50 miles to the Critical Mass. And, you know, when I got there, Willie Brown was up on a platform saying, "You will not ride Market." And I suppose people did boo, but what I remember more was just people yelling, "Get a bike, Willie," and streaming onto Market thousands. And so, you know, I can well imagine how that helped the SFBC and the rest of us around the world, because it was when we stood up. So thank you so much, because I know all of you had some part of it. I had a really specific, much less interesting question, well, not interesting, but much more specific sort of nuanced question, which is that, you know, there's always the lure of getting into being an elected official or onto state, you know, different power within the system. And I know, Lee, you did that. So could you or maybe others, Dave or ever, talk about, you know, the pros and cons of what transpired?
Sure. Real quickly, what he's referring to is about 2 years ago, our mayor appointed me to a 7-person body called the Municipal Transportation Agency Board of Directors. It was a huge surprise. We were actually lobbying for people to get on there, not expecting that to happen, but trying, because that's our job, because they're the decision makers for streets, for everything, bikes, transit, cars. And he actually turned around and said, "How about you?" Which is a real surprise, because our agency, our organization had not been real friendly with him, frankly. I mean, we hadn't endorsed him, but that was a surprise. So I got appointed to it. Keep in mind, I was a one person on a 7-person board. I was on for a year and a half, and he plucked me off. So a little bit of context there is I didn't get reappointed.
He illegally plucked you off, too.
Thank you, Ivan. This was really interesting. But I replaced a few people at the time, but I was one of them. And for good reason, I think he didn't really understand what it would mean to have an advocate on there. I want to be honest that I think I learned, you know, one person on a seven-person board wasn't going to be able to achieve a lot. And I was in a weird spot of being the head of an advocacy organization and, you know, now part of city government, basically. And that had some real constrictions. I don't know that I would recommend it to somebody. Not to say that I think you should be trying to get good, strong advocates on there. But if it's their paying job as well, that's, I think, you know, can be hard. But I do, in my opinion, we should be getting more bicycling advocates and everyone advocates, people who believe in our stuff, elected and appointed to powers of position. I think that is
like our mayor.
Like your mayor. Congratulations.
And she was definitely not playing punches on the commission, because I was interviewing the mayor just after he vetoed something called Healthy Saturdays, which is a big fight over a very small car-free space in Golden Gate Park that the advocates more or less lost, kind of at a compromise that got some of the things. It was quoted in the paper basically saying that it negates every good environmental thing he's ever done and shouldn't be called himself an environmentalist anymore.
Right.
Is it active?
This idea of congestion tax, and I mean, thank you very much for putting this whole conversation in the context of neocons and neoliberalism and such. From a friend of mine who lives in London, it doesn't sound like it's so successful. It just basically means that the rich people who have big, stupid-ass vehicles anyway, who can burn money, are the only ones who can afford to drive down there. And it kind of puts it in this way of, well, the guy with the little car who's a janitor can't go to work now, and the big guys with money. I would love to hear, Chris, or I would love to hear a little bit about pro and con on this issue.
The first thing I'll say, though, and then I think Dave, because his organization is the one that's going to be pushing it. But what I'll say is that, you know, the way they did it in London was probably a good progressive neoliberal marriage or bridge, because the key is in the United States transportation discourse, you've got a whole faction that supports pricing from the right, from the neoliberal side. But what they want is rationing road space, obviously, so the wealthy can drive faster, but also to build more roads. So in Southern California, pricing is extremely popular in the political discourse of the right wing, but it's about toll roads and private toll roads, and it's to build more roads. In London, the money for the congestion pricing is being funneled back into a transit system, into improvements to bicycling and pedestrians. And what I'm hearing in London, and I haven't been to see for myself, but what I'm hearing is that speeds have come back down to the slow level that they were before, but that's also because they've taken away road space. So I think the London model is probably one to look at as a sort of a real politique, understanding that, you know, until we smash capitalism or whatever, you're going to have sort of a political alliance where, you know, the business class is going to be like, yeah, we got to get the UPS trucks running better. The taxi drivers are going to be like, yeah, this makes us run better. Let's tax the rich, but the money doesn't go to new roads in London. It goes to a transit system. So that's about all I would say from my angle. I think Dave wanted to.
I just want to say that I have a hard time buying that argument that's going to hurt poor people worse. I think as a society, we cannot afford our car dependence. We totally, as a society, can't. And we've got to figure out alternatives, and we need money to do that. And from motorists is a very appropriate place to get that money. Yes, if you are a contractor and you have to drive your truck to do jobs, an independent contractor, your costs will go up, and that will cause inflation in the cost of getting someone to lay a floor. You know, that it will increase costs for doing business, and that's appropriate, and that's okay. I really think that if we spend 100% of the money on alternatives to the car, and especially alternatives that help the lowest income people, that it's completely appropriate.
Well, and it's a good balance, because a lot of the studies that were the preliminary studies going into the study talked about how our core in San Francisco is the second most congested downtown core after Houston. And, you know, it cited a huge multi-billion-dollar economic impact from that kind of congestion. So.
I guess I would, just to piggyback off of what you just said, Dave, I think part of the problem goes back to what you were saying in your presentation, that the bike movement and even the car-free movement as a whole is represented by some middle-class and very privileged white people as their spokespeople. And so to kind of change the discussion and to make sure that some of the decisions we make in the future, both on the policy level and the advocacy level, don't exclude folks who might feel excluded by something like congestion pricing, we need to change the discourse and make sure that it's involving more people so that it's not just a middle-class movement.
And that's happening in San Francisco, and I think that's happening here. The Coalition for the Livable Future in Portland is paying attention to that. In San Francisco, the social equity organizations are not supporting congestion pricing until they understand its impacts on low-income people better, and there are maybe means testing involved or something like that. So I think that's happening.
While we're talking about congestion pricing, I just want to add that there are other cities that have thought about congestion pricing, and the best example is Zurich, Switzerland. And they thought about it for about 2 seconds. And then they said, you know what? What we're going to do is we're just going to take away car space, period. So the rich people are still stuck in traffic. And we're going to put in bus lanes and bike lanes and remove parking spaces. And, you know, but the difference between a place like that in the United States is that in Switzerland, you've got a strong federal system that taxes the automobile, so you have money coming into the transit system. But in the United States, there's so much devolution of funding that each locality is being forced to find its own pot of money to pay, and sales taxes are regressive. So, you know, it's a question you have to ask yourself, which is more regressive, congestion pricing or sales taxes, because that's what we're being left with. There was a story earlier this week in the Bay Area about a year and a half ago. A 10-cent gas tax was polling pretty good. Okay, today it's not polling pretty good, and that's because now gas is $4.50 in the Bay Area. So the average populace is like, I'm not paying 10 cents, even if it does go to global warming reduction. So we're in a situation where we can't talk about raising gas taxes in political reality. And we're in devolution world, right, where everybody, Democrats and Republicans, are, you got to pay more of your share locally. And so San Francisco's exploring congestion pricing is a result of that bigger political environment.
Because our agency that's in charge is taking, you know, as a result of the governor's budget, taking like a $40 million hit. At the same time, it's got a maxed system, more or less, that it is trying to expand. So that's the financial challenge.
I want to just add, too, it's like there's something completely perverse and insane about a society that allows the conversation to be shaped by the notion that every single public service should pay for itself. Yeah. It's ridiculous. There ought to be free public transit for everybody, period, and it should be super efficient and super extensive, and it's just a part of the infrastructure of life. I would remind us all, it's not very hard to figure it out. We are bombing other parts of the world and maintaining 137 military bases around the world. Where's the money? That's what it is.
You and then you. Oh, right. Back here.
Okay. So on that note, given that I would think one of your strongest opponents would probably be like the entertainment like crowd, but like a lot of people I know who drive into the city are doing so like in the evenings because they can't ride them for any later than midnight.
Well,
I'm just wondering if you all can speculate on the potential of BART to actually go beyond midnight, because
24 hours, no.
Yeah. Well, it needs BART needs to add a track underneath the trans between the, what she's talking about is over here, and BART has a variety of reasons. One is that they need to shut the tunnel every night and do some maintenance work, so they need to add another track, but that takes us to the money. But the congestion charge, as it's being analyzed right now, would just be a peak period. But that raises a whole bunch of other interesting issues, because actually, sometimes the peak period is Saturday midday. You get more cars coming in, sporting events, and all this kind of stuff. But what they're really talking about is, the commute hours in the morning until the evening. So the entertainment lobby, if you will, may not have to worry as much. But, you know, I think you raise a very good point, because parking pricing, which is another pricing, would definitely be tapping into the entertainment lobby, because that would be in the evening.
We're all baffled by this issue, because we all totally support that.
I'd like to hear your opinions on how Mayor Gavin Newsom said that they now have a public bike program, and that
through the process of advertising and all that, that eventually it turned into that it won't cost the city anything if Clear Channel or some other major advertiser gets over the city with advertising. But, I mean, that is it, and nothing's happened there, but what do you think about that maneuver that the mayor's doing?
Our mayor is really good at talking about great green stuff. And not so good with follow-through. You may have mayors like this. Ours are really good at that. So he went to Lyon, France, saw this wonderful bike share program a couple years ago. We all woke up and read the paper and said, bike sharing coming to San Francisco. That's great. About a year later, we saw two lines written into a contract for Clear Channel to get the transit outdoor shelter advertising agreement. The two lines, it's literally a paragraph. It's about this long. The little paragraph says they have the option to do it one day. Nothing about how or when or you know, definitely must do. Nothing at all. So in a sense, I think he probably thinks he's checked off that box or so. Now we need to come in and figure out how do you actually do it. So I feel like there's been interest there. There's tons of people interested in the concept in San Francisco, but there's not yet the political commitment or leadership for it.
He also announced the Ciclovia, which we're going to have in August for 3 days. What that actually ends up looking like in Governor Newsom's hands, we'll see.
I'm a little more optimistic about the bike sharing thing. I mean, they're hiring a staff person who will start in July, whose job it is to negotiate that contract with Clear Channel. If they can't negotiate with them, they'll negotiate it with someone else. You talked about the advertising and whether it will cost. Well, advertising is a cost. It probably costs the city several million bucks. They'll make that money either through taxes or by allowing Clear Channel to market and advertise on every, you know, blank piece of wall in the city. One way or the other, but we'll have it. And so within a couple, three years, I think we'll have a really awesome public bike system.
But it is neoliberal. Because they just sold public space to Clear Channel. And this is a beef that I have, and I'll just real quick, you know, putting all these ads on the transit systems, like, you know, covering buses with McDonald's ads. That's this whole, you know, well, we have to pay for, it has to pay for itself. And it's commodifying public space, and that's the neoliberal trend. And I think progressives at some point are going to have to say, you know what, you know, selling off the side of the bus for a McDonald's ad is just not cutting it, you know, and it doesn't really bring in that much money.
In my paper, I like hell, by the way.
Yeah, I know, and we've had ballot initiatives.
Only
on
money in town to fight it, really. Yeah.
It doesn't provide a safe place to ride, either. It provides a free bicycle.
Yeah.
And Chris is going to buy the one next year, right? I love public spaces, too.
This question is mostly directed at Dave. When you're talking about the bike movement being, you know, it's a mature movement now, and that we need to start focusing on expanding the movement to other car-free movements and transit so we can make it grow and be more diverse. I'm wondering if that's coming from the perspective of working in a city where you do have 10,000 members in your coalition. And, you know, I live in Portland now, but I'm originally from Ohio, where we struggle to keep 200 members in our local advocacy group, which is, you know, pretty much a pub crawl. And I'm wondering if...
I think they're all like that.
I'm wondering if... Hey, that's how we started Shift here. At a blues. But I'm curious if you believe that those cities where it's ripe, I mean, it's ready for a bike movement, things have really grown there in the past year even, but do you think that we should focus on bikes now to expand to car-free later, or if we should bring them in while we're still in our infancy in Midwestern cities and cities where, you know, there's sprawl and much larger barriers?
I think it has to be organic, and probably it's going to grow among the group of bike riders who are, you know, privileged people who demand better access. I mean, the soundbite that I meant to say in my talk was, we're organizing people who are used to getting what they want in their life, and when they don't get it, they're at least used to being treated with respect and nicely. And they get honked at and abused and threatened their very lives when they ride their bicycles. It's the only time when they're not treated like a first-class citizen. And they get angry, and they say, what can I do about it? Who can I write a check to? You know, and I'm here, and Leah's here to say, you know, San Francisco Bike Coalition. We'll solve your problem. And so I you know, where you're, so, and you've got to take advantage of that. I mean, you know, it's going to be organic, and that's okay. That's the way these things work. When I said it's mature, it's because the national movement has money now. They're actually, they just got a big grant. I don't even know if this is that public yet. Turn off your thing.
This is going to be broadcast around the world in a week.
They just got a big grant, and it hasn't been, the details haven't been negotiated yet, to make a mini grant to organizations around the country.
This is the Thunderhead Alliance?
Thunderhead Alliance, yeah.
So hopefully
they can say, here's 40 grand, this is how you can get started, right? So like groups that are ready but they don't have the money yet can roll, and we leaders who are already established need to figure out how to go beyond that. And I don't have an answer.
If I could just, I don't know if mature is exactly the word I would choose, but I think the bicycle movement, I hope we are mature, but sometimes the bicycle movement is effective in so many cities because we're so mobilized so directly. I mean, our people turn out the stuff and do stuff because it affects us so directly, and they care about the bigger picture, right? It's our movement in San Francisco and probably a lot of places that helps this woman on San Jose Avenue get traffic calming on her street. It's our movement, the bicyclists, who help so-and-so get parking taken away on their street. It's our movement that helps calm the street right in front of a school. Time and time again, what we see is that bicycle activists are the change agents that help other things. I don't think it has to be that way, but I think there's a reason it is that way, and I'm happy to play that role as long as it's always getting bigger and bigger towards the car free.
And the San Francisco Chronicle is now taking the call in their organization, a powerful special interest.
I'm really glad to see such a broad spectrum of people out here on this panel. So there's people that are working with the system, people working despite the system. We've seen Car Busters magazine decide, okay, no, we're not going to call it Car Busters, this conference, we're going to call it something else, the World Car Free Network, so that we can bring more people onto it. In my hometown in Toronto, there's a whole bunch of shit going on right now. There's a cyclist union that's being formed. People are doing critical mass style rides, but they're scared of critical mass, so they do bells on Bloor. We had 1,500 people ride on Bloor Street saying, we want a bike lane on Bloor. At the same time, critical mass itself, the more radical charge element, felt so empowered that 3 days after the bells on Bloor ride, critical mass took the Gardiner Expressway, a giant freeway, and made the front page of the Sun with our bike lane rags. And so what's happening here is like we've got a movement that's growing so quickly, so fast, that it's starting to splinter, and there's a lot of infighting going on. A lot of our movement got its knickers in a knot, saying, well, "You're ruining what we're doing. Why did you go and ride on the Gardiner when we've got bells on Bloor? We've got the cyclist union. We've got our pragmatic approach, and we're starting to work with the city. Why are you doing that?" So, what my question is how can we continue to expand and make this movement grow? How can we broaden it? How can we color it? Color it by meaning by bringing people of color into it, bringing other people in. And how can we still keep it cohesive, keep it together?
Don't.
Well, I mean, I've actually got a book out that we talked about already, but it's Nowtopia, and I actually think that bicycling, and I think it's an important point that it made, is that bicycling is not the end. It's a piece of a larger transformation that we're all involved with, which involves reinventing the technology of our everyday lives that puts it into some sort of biological sanity and ecological harmony, which we know how to do. It's not like rocket science. We actually could do this. But we don't have the large social mandate, the large social movement in place to bring it about automatically or quickly. So people are taking all these different kinds of initiatives, and I don't think the divisiveness or the splintering is at all a problem. I think it's extremely good because you need to argue. One of the problems of North American radical and even mainstream culture is this fear of argument. It's, oh my God, we're disagreeing. Everything's going to fall apart now. We don't like each other anymore.
Well, what's funny, too, there's a lot of the same people that are the same people that were on the next CIC bike ride and the bells on Bloor are in the front of critical mass taking.
Sure. Yeah, of course. And I think that there's a lot of different roles to play, but it's really important that as these things get really dynamic and exciting, that we keep the individuals like us who are involved in it just have to keep pushing the envelopes out in terms of what's at stake.
Okay, so
let me just add to answer the question about how do you get more people? How do you like sort of like what Jesse Jackson used to say about the Rainbow Coalition or whatever? I think that Leah brought up a point about not trying to convince everybody that they have to ride a bike, but look at sort of your market niche. I hate to use that word. I'm not a neoliberal, but you know, in this poll here, these are the 33% of San Francisco voters who say, well, you know, I'm there with you, but I'm not riding because of whatever reason. And there was some study in Britain a few years ago that about 20% of the British population is there, but not cycling right now.
We call them the orange people in Portland, the interested but
right.
concerned.
And I think that, that maybe strategically you focus on them. And you figure out, well, who is your sort of natural clientele that you're trying to just bring over to maybe once a week or everyday cycling, but also just the whole sort of idea. I mean, I think, you know, with global warming, peak oil, you know, Middle Eastern politics, whatever, there's all these this convergence of things, and people are kind of ready for that change. And, you know, maybe in the U.S. tapping into the Obama thing, I know Obama came and 5,000 people rode their bikes, and that made all around the country. But I think, you know, Leah's point about not saying to every single person, you need to change your lifestyle, but to focus on these people that are saying, I do it, but.
I want to jump on that, because the thing to add to that that's really important is that this idea of not forcing people to make a specific change, because there's a subcultural exclusivity and self-righteous moralism that permeates the radical environmental movement, whichever part of it you're in, is this kind of tisk tisk, you're not cool, you're an idiot, you don't live the right way, I've chosen the right way, you haven't done it yet, you're actually the insane. It gets worse in like Critical Mass, where you get the young men out there who think there's a class war between cars and bikes, you know, it's absurd. So you have to figure out how to invite people to join, right, and make it a fun thing and really interesting. And the key to that, which is what I think we all fail on all the time, we have to get much better at articulating how much better life can be. And if we just go around saying, well, things are terrible, you should join us. Things are terrible, you should join us. Really, it's bad, so we got to do something. That's not very inspiring. I'd rather just go and read a book. But if you tell me, your life's going to get way better, and you're going to meet new people and have a much more dynamic experience of everyday life by coming along on one of these things and coming to have a meal with me or whatever, then there's room for people to join without feeling like it's all out of the guilt and sacrifice.
Wait, so this is another thing, too. I come from a city where you hear 220 languages in the street. It's supposedly the most diverse city in the world. And yet, when I go to a meeting, I'm the only non-white guy in the
yeah.
group. Why is that? Why aren't people of color seeing this as a social justice issue? This is as something that's affecting their health, it's affecting the third world. How do we get a broader range of
Well, that's starting to happen in a lot of places. There is a pretty strong environmental justice movement in the Bay Area, and you really do see much broader constituencies of people showing up at these things, and usually in their communities. So like in Richmond district, Richmond area of the Bay Area, which is where the oil refineries are, very black area, you get a large African-American population showing up to contest these things and participate in conversations. So it's just a matter of breaking out of our own ghettos and stopping the self-segregation that we all reproduce.
Well, and I want to add to that. I mean, I don't, this is not really the panel to answer that question quite. but we can try. I mean, it's our responsibility to try. And what I think, what I know, the limited bit I know about sort of, you know, racial justice is that groups that start out as white-dominated groups almost always stay that way. It's really hard for them to change. They're not going to change and maybe just relax about that. What I think we could do is work with communities of color and self-represented groups like that and give them grants. If we have an organization with $1 million budget and there's a neighborhood organization with a $50,000 budget and they're trying to improve their community, give them $20,000 and say, hey, will you work for Bike Lanes in your community with this $20,000? And they'll say, sure. Right, like that's a way that I think we can bridge some of those gaps, and it's worth it to us. We got the money.
Oh, I've already had a chance to.
You did? Okay, good.
Yeah.
I came for education and entertainment, and you guys have really delivered. To Chris, is it possible?
Just later after cocktails. Really?
Isn't it possible to appropriate the? I got to use the word discourse, don't I? That's compulsory.
Are you talking to me or Chris?
I'm sorry.
Jason?
Yeah. You look like a Chris.
Oh.
The language of national security. It's the patriotic issue here, which legitimate around oil, peak oil, you listed it, almost every respect. But can you actually take that language and maybe even legitimate neoconservative viewpoint and integrate it into this?
You know, that's an interesting angle, and I think there's definitely something there. What I think about is that, you know, the majority of the population of this country lives in a suburban area, and most of their daily trips are between, say, a mile and 5 miles, and there's a tremendous opportunity to use a bicycle in that format. And also there's sort of a libertarian side to bicycling. I can leave when I want. I can go door to door. I don't have to wait for the bus. This was an argument that was made in a political science book about bicycling that came out this year. And I think that that's a sort of a political angle you can make. And I think that there is a libertarian streak in that white male cycling segment of the population. So, I mean, I think that's definitely worth, you know, everything's contextual. It depends on where you are. You know, if you're in Atlanta, making that libertarian argument probably has more resonance than if you're in Toronto or the Excelsior District in San Francisco. So, you know, I think you got to be strategic about what your local politics is. You know, I spent 7 years in Athens, Georgia, you know, and we called it courteous mass because the cops would have bashed our heads in if we tried to run red lights without them blocking for us or whatever. And it was a way of diffusing the possibility of it getting kind of out of control. But I think you got to kind of take it contextually, and I think a libertarian, it's patriotic to not use Middle Eastern oil. I don't know. I think that'll only get you so far, though, because it's then it makes it about their oil, but not the Gulf. You know, it can get co-opted as in, well, we should drill in Alaska.
Yeah, no,
you know, so there, it gets real tricky, but I think there's some interesting there, but I think the libertarian side might have more.
We've got about 5 more minutes here, so let's try to cover a few more in the back there.
Yeah, well, first, just a quick comment on national security and non-motorized modes. The number one means of evacuating Manhattan on 9/11 was walking.
Mm-hmm.
And so having transportation alternatives, being able to bike and being able to walk, can be an important way to evacuate in an emergency. And I could go on with that for a long time. But my new question was, what's been the relation between the bicycle and the pedestrian advocates in the Bay Area?
I get called all the time by financiers that had to walk San Francisco that I write way too much about bike issues, not nearly enough about pedestrian issues. But anybody else?
Well, there's the bike sidewalk issue, which you probably...
Yeah, I would say I'm pretty sure the Bicycle Coalition and Walk San Francisco actually share an office. Mike Smith, who helped start Walk San Francisco, our main pedestrian group, is sitting right here, kicking props. We have very close relations in that we, you know, agree with all the big things we're all working on. I'll be honest, I think for very good reason, the pedestrian movement has an inferiority complex in San Francisco and lots of places because they don't get the attention and respect they deserve. They aren't, sadly, as well organized. You know, you can go on and on about why aren't they as organized. Frankly, sadly, I don't think it's as much fun and as energizing to walk as to bike. Not that I don't walk and love biking and want to, we work a lot on pedestrian issues too, but there's that community sense that's not in the pedestrian piece. And I think across the country, they've had a really hard time getting over that and making that an effective movement. So I think, you know, where there is a little bit of bristling, I think it's mostly around that. But Mike might have more comments.
Is something on that? We started the pedestrian movement in San Francisco about 10 years or something like that. It was all bicyclists who started it. And the reason we did that is because we realized that, well, okay, we're a bunch of young white people, and it's difficult to get racial minorities and such. But it's easy to get old people. A lot of pedestrians are older people, and they're not going to bike. In fact, they hate bicyclists. Yet they look really great at City Hall. They show up early. They make their own signs and things like that. And no politician wants to go against a nice old senior. So there's so much potential in enhancing the pedestrian movement. The problem is that with bicycling, you know, you got your funny shoes, you got your funny hats, you know, people identify as bicyclists and such. Pedestrians don't identify as pedestrians. And so I really recommend, especially in cities like Portland, that it's time to really emphasize pedestrian movement, but it's really difficult too because people don't identify as pedestrians.
I would just add real quickly, though, I think we're at the stage now where we need to be talking about the public spaces. I think New York's doing a great job of this, and San Francisco, we need to be doing it more. We throw that in every now and then, but it's not the overarching like context or dialogue, and it needs to be. It needs to be about the spaces that we're all moving through, no matter what mode you're in. Well, and that's where we're at, I think.
And it's easy to do that around dangerous spaces. We just had Walk SF, the Bike Coalition, and The Guardian, a bunch of people over the last 2 years put a lot of pressure on the city to deal with this particularly dangerous intersection at Mark Octavia and Phil Masonic, is what I was thinking. The city went back to court, got a special exemption from this court injunction to be able to fix this intersection that was really dangerous for both pedestrians and cyclists. So,
You guys have 5 minutes left, just so you know.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
So some of the things that you just touched on, including kind of an emphasis on common spaces, maybe kind of think back to what I've been stewing on, since the question about including more people of color in movements like this. But this is typical in progressive movements in general. You know, like you said, it's typically led by privileged white people, et cetera, et cetera. What I know from working with people of color in neighborhoods like Baby Hunter's Plain, San Francisco, for example, that is facing like rampant environmental injustice, being ignored, making empty promises by mayor after mayor after mayor, et cetera, et cetera, is the way to get people to work together, people of color, and, you know, working together with other progressives and their movements and their issues, is to work on theirs. And right now, as you know, what's facing, you know, an area, a neighborhood like Baby Hunter's Point is this whole redevelopment, mm-hmm. and the fact that there's, you know, these power plants that have just caused so much pollution and disease, asthma, diabetes, and so many incredible problems going on in that neighborhood. And it seems to me that given the neighborhood is trying to develop that area into a friendly common space that incorporates the things that they want, that they've been talking about at all their public meetings, that groups like SFDC could be working with them to help create that, because you already have cachet, you already have a lot of recognition citywide, and that if you show yourself to be an ally and other groups show themselves to be allies, two groups that are working in these neighborhoods that are primarily people of color and primarily very poor, that we could maybe make some progress, but we need to sort of go to them. That's the way it always
works. So after the November election, there was this big ballot initiative to require more parking in San Francisco. But at the same time, there was another ballot initiative to reform Muni. And that ballot initiative was supported by the unions, which are diverse, which are ethnically diverse. And so there was this moment in the fall where you had this sort of coalescing of interests around defeating the parking proposition and approving the reform of the transportation, the transit system proposition. And there was this moment where, what was it called? The Transit Not Traffic Coalition sort of materialized out of that. But I really haven't been involved in it since then, so I'm not sure. But Dave has tried to forge this type of coalition, and maybe you could say a little about where it is now.
I mean, it's still struggling. We're continuing to work together well. We don't have much to show for it yet. I mean, what's interesting is that it includes the transit workers union, which is, I think, important for transit justice, pro-transit, anti-car movement and organization to include transit workers. It's hard because a lot of transit activists think that the drivers and the benefits that they get as workers are part of the problem of why we don't have a good enough transit system. And you've got to overcome that objection I think, make a stronger coalition, but I don't have much else to say.
Like one last question at the end.
Maybe a question and an observation, I guess. My question is, do you think the battle is mostly half over, or even two-thirds over? Because now it seems to be you guys are in the negotiation stage. And my observation was, like, I'll date myself. I was in the room, and Chris Carlson walked in, and it was over those months, it was like Dave Snyder and Joel Pomerantz, and sent to me, John Poshman, Dallas Graba, Colley, Donald, myself. And several of us tried to get past an endorsement, get the SFDC to endorse Critical Mass, and yet we always lost by one vote. Like, it was like 4-3 every couple of months. And yet, when it came down to negotiating, in 97, and maybe that's the point when the battle was partially won, in that SFDC did go in there and do some negotiating, would you say the battle partially won, was that the date?
Peter is the number one person in the Bike Coalition's 30,000 person database. I just want to note that. Every day when I turn my database on, I look at his name. He lives in New York City, but he's still a member.
I'm asking because I'm still a member.
This is your dues at work, man.
Yeah, I'm really curious. Like, I didn't know that, so.
No, I should say, it is confusing. None of us was in that room in terms of the Bike Coalition negotiating. The Bike Coalition didn't promise anything, is what my understanding is, and was misrepresented afterwards. Maybe shouldn't have gone into the room at all. That is definitely a valid question. But I think that, I don't think it was hack one there, but I think what happened there was this more public awakening, where all of a sudden there was this public discourse about biking in a way that there never had been before, and it opened these doors to everybody.
So maybe that was the turning point.
It was our stonewall.
I think that we need to really we're far from over in this, and that I just want to illustrate here that these cars are leaving the dense, walkable, compact, so-called sustainable neighborhood at 8 o'clock in the morning. And they're going to Mountain View or Menlo Park. Right here, they're going down here. And what's happening in San Francisco is that the politics is getting a little bit more conservative. Day by day, a suburbanization is occurring, where what happens is a Victorian gets bought and a garage gets inserted underneath. And you know, instead of a funky little corner coffee shop, it's now a very upscale lingerie or whatever, right?
Or a 40-story vertical gated community.
Right, or a gated community with parking underneath. And, you know, yeah, they're buying the city as a spectacle. And they're like, wow, I can't live in Menlo Park. I can't live in Mountain View. So they're buying the city as a spectacle, as a commodity. But they're pricing out everyone. And that's why I just keep emphasizing that, you know, the housing side of this. If we're going to forge a coalition, we've got to stay on the housing side of this. But San Francisco, I mean, the supervisor that you showed, Chris Daly, his district is ground zero for going from far left progressive to basically neoliberal sort of consumption of the city as a spectacle.
So the,
I mean, that's where the condos are going
in. So the battle of San Francisco is going to rage on for years to come.
only time will tell.
I'd like to thank and acknowledge the Oz behind the panel, Brian Smith, with Carper USA, organizer behind this. And thank you all for
coming. And so ends another stimulating conversation from the Towards Car Free Cities Conference in Portland, Oregon, in June 2008. Everybody reading from their playbook and playing their part at that table there. And the conversation went on. We ended up having to get kicked out of the room, make room for the next workshop that was happening. There were arguments and fights, and it was all very good-natured, and everybody still loves each other now. But it was interesting. I'm going to draw this show to an end. There will be a few more of these Portland car-free episodes. I want to remind you that you can get in touch with me by writing to bikescape@sbcglobal.net. You can leave a message, a voice message, by dialing a phone number, the number which I do not have right now. There's no Wi-Fi at this coffee house. But if you go to bikescape.blogspot.com, look over in the right column, there's the phone numbers right there. Call it, leave a message. I will get a WAV file in my mail, and I will include it in the next show. So don't be afraid. I'll edit it. I'll make it sound good. So, and also you can leave comments at the blog. You can get links and review the old shows, all the archive shows going back more than 3 years now at bikescape.blogspot.com. So until the next show, keep that rubber side down and take the lane. Bye now. San Francisco Bay, where those liners took us up.
shame that I'm feeling blue. Right all the way to the end of the line, just thinking of you. Meanwhile, in another city, just about to go insane. Well, I thought I heard my baby way. Just about to go insane. Well, I thought I heard my baby wave.